Right, we are in CLR and .NET world. We're continuing with our 4-5 story. We are talking to developers today. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Dave Keane. I'm a dev on the CoreFX team for CLR and BCL.
Excellent.
And I'm Mircea Trofin, or Mitch.
Okay.
I'm a PM in the same team.
Excellent. So we're here today, we're going to talk about these portable .NET libraries.
Yep.
What's going on here? What are these?
Okay, so portable libraries is basically, it's two things. It's a set of tools, VS tools, to enable you to basically create what we call these libraries, which run on multiple platforms, you know, phone, .NET, Silverlight,
Xbox
and so forth, and at the same time, basically enable you to build these libraries that, you know, a single time, and then run them on multiple platforms. There's kind of two parts to this. There's the tools themselves, so, you know, file a new project to create a template and so forth, and that's what the customer sees. But behind the scenes, there's a bunch of things. There's a lot of runtime changes that we need to make, across, work with multiple teams to make this basically happen. Mm-hmm. Across, you know, that we work with something like 25 teams across Microsoft to end up basically to enable this.
Great. So, I mean, so, the basic concept then, I would assume, is pointing at the program manager. You're supposed to be the visionary behind this stuff, right? That's what a program manager does. So,
really?
Maybe not. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. The dev makes it real. The program manager gets to make specs and stuff. So, let me ask you this question. Portability is important to developers, right? And so, typically in .NET, that hasn't really been the case, because they've been either targeting Silverlight or they've been targeting the desktop, which is just Windows. Yeah. So, in this case, I'm a developer. I want to build a portable library. He's talking about tools that I can use, right? What does it mean to be a portable library? Like, I'm going to be very, very restricted in what I can implement.
I wouldn't call it very restrictive. So today you already have a set of facilities that let you build enough in the portable subset that you can actually, like we have sample applications, for example, where a Flickr client, you know, everybody knows Flickr, right? The picture, the photo sharing web service. So everything but the XAML is the same, actually. So it's sufficient to write the business logic, the communication logic, everything that doesn't have to do with the presentation part, right? Mm. Now, you're asking me what's it mean to build a portable library, or what does this entail for you? So our customer is that kind of developer or organization that wants to, typically that wants to have an incarnation of their application across a variety of form factors, like the ones that we enumerated before, right? Mm-hmm. And their customers see no reason that these sort of applications shouldn't kind of be similar, right? Like, I mean, how many ways are you going to do something like Flickr, right?
Yeah.
Conversely to the developer themselves, they don't see any reason why they should write anything more than once if it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
What typically happened before the portable library project was people would write actually things once, but then they would be forced into doing things like if devs or partial classes or things like this that don't really scale well, are complicated to analyze by the developer themselves, right? Mm. And was one of the things that people found as a big benefit, that they don't have to do this anymore with a portable library subset. So, I mean, the experience that we give developers is very easy. You go, you create a new project, you call it portable, you say what you want it to run on, and you go ahead and you code like just like you would normally, like no if-devs, no tricks, no nothing. Mm-hmm. You compile the result, and it's good as is, as a binary. You can reuse it as a binary, I can give it to you, and you can reuse it on the platforms that I said that it should be running on, or you can reuse it from your own other code.
Interesting. Now, of course, you know, I can't, so you said I can program however I want, but there's going to be certain classes and types or classes that I can't use.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly.
Yeah, so we started this project about 2 odd years ago, And as we started digging deeper into it, you know, it became clear that, you know, these platforms, for whatever reason, you know, kind of fragmented it over time. And, you know, the surface area that was available in Silverlight and what was available on phone differed slightly to what was available on .NET. A good example of this is, like, the networking stack, for example. So, you know, most of the networking stack across these three platforms that I'm talking about there is very similar. They have the same method, you know, very similar methods and so forth, but there's no way to actually create one of these commonly across these. So, you know, when we first started investigating this, we started hitting into a lot of those things. And, you know, at first, we would basically work with these teams to try and, you know, come up with a way of, you know, fixing some of these things that were in common, or, you know, weren't in common, or, you know, by adding APIs or by reducing the surface area that we expose to customers and so forth. And yes, there's things that you can't do. For you know, some technologies only ship on certain platforms. For example, MEF. MEF is owned by my team as well, and you know, MEF is only available on Silverlight, and it's only available on .NET. So when you create a new portable library and you unselect phone, you know, it becomes available then. But if you select phone again, you know that you can't program against MEF because there's literally no MEF on phone.
Sure.
So as you tend to choose more platforms, yes, the surface area that you can program against that's common among across these platforms is limited. And, you know, Xbox is a good example. Like, as soon as you choose Xbox, you have no networking stack. But it's good for, if, you know, you want to ship some sort of algorithm or something across these.
Totally.
You know, then it's perfect for that.
I was going to say, like, this is not... So what we need to understand is that this effort started after a lot of these platforms shipped, of course, right? So what we're observing is there's two categories of APIs that you cannot use in the portable library subset. One is, well, it doesn't make sense. It's not really portable, right? Like, I mean... something that is, for example, ASP.NET, right? Like, I mean, well, that kind of works only on the server. It makes no sense to put that on,
sure,
on the phone, right?
Yep.
Okay. So those will never be because they don't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. The second category is, well, they should, but there's too much divergence there in the APIs because of the way things are. So, in other words, this is the only reason. And in some of these latter cases, as David was saying, we made an effort into, like, where it was possible to actually bring convergence,
mm-hmm,
and that required working with a lot of teams to actually bring new APIs, ensure behavioral compatibilities. And you'd be surprised how, like, what kind of little changes are necessary in order to make this actually happen, but how impactful the small change actually ends up being.
Sure.
Like you were saying, you couldn't create before... In a portable way, a networking stack, right? Well, it turned out we needed to add one method, right? Like, that's it. Like, from the end customer perspective,
yeah,
it won them a lot in terms of actual work. That, I mean, you know, it's a method at the end of the day, right? Yeah.
You'd be surprised at how hard that method was.
Yeah, to actually convince all across the board. But,
that's a good thing. So
there's
implemented it.
Yeah, I mean, somebody implemented it, and it needed to be implemented on the relevant platforms.
Of course.
But I mean, okay, so that multiplies the cost by 2 or 3, whatever that was. But we're not talking about big philosophies here, right?
Sure.
And if you look, so today we have an out-of-band release that is available. I'm not going to recite here a link, I hope.
Sure. You don't have to. It's on the gallery, right?
Yeah.
Visual Studio Gallery.
So... there is the amount of APIs portable there is what we could do by that time, right? Like, I mean, so there's more things that can be brought into the future. Like, in the future, we're actually shipping in Dev 11 in the Pro or better boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time, you should see a bit more. But people need to understand where, like, there were lines that were drawn either because of, well, it just doesn't make sense, mm-hmm. or because at this point in time, we wish we could, but
it just... Another reason was that basically we wanted to be, we wanted to get as much feedback as possible before, you know, we knew that we're going to ship this in the box. Yeah. So, you know, we kind of made a trade-off where we said, well, you know, the surface area that you program against, you know, in the what we call the U, which is on Visual Studio Gallery, is not as great as what we'd hoped. It's kind of enough to get people interested and say, oh, this is a great idea, I wish you could add this, I wish you could add this. And based on, you know, some of the feedback that we've already got, we've added those things in, you know, yeah. in Dev 11.
I mean, the typical feedback that we got was great, but we want more. And we're like, I know.
Yes, we know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, well, we did more than just ideas. Like, so yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. This is the rare time where we'll see a PM and Dev agree so easily. but you know, in some sense, it seems like the canonical example of where this is really useful is in just sort of functionality libraries shared across platforms, right? Because if you think about the phone and its UI, its Metro kind of experience, that doesn't make sense to build a thing that takes over then to the Xbox. It doesn't have that same concept. So the shared functionality, just like in other library-heavy languages like C++, you use a library to compute the best math library you can find, right, that can run across platforms.
Yeah, but I wouldn't... So, as Mitch was mentioning...
I mean, that's before, a question, not a statement.
Yeah, yeah. So the Mitch was saying that, the presentation layer, across these devices, you know, the views that, you know, you're going to use on the phone is going to be slightly different to, you know, different experience for the tablet.
For good reasons.
Yeah, for good reasons. You want to fit into those platforms. So this is why the write once, you know, run everywhere app is not the goal that we're trying to hit here. It's more the... The presentation layer downwards, you know, you kind of have a lot of things like, if you use WPF, Silverlight, and phone, you probably had heard about this thing called view models and so forth. And, you know, as you'll see in Dev 11, as we move further in the Dev 11 cycle, you know, you'll see a lot more of this kind of code be shareable across these platforms. So, today you'll notice in the out of band package that, your view models aren't, you can't share iNotify property change, for example, which is a fairly core type for view models. And, you can only share it if you choose phone and Silverlight. And there's a lot of reasons behind this. You know, today they're in different locations and so forth, but, as we move forward, we're fixing a lot of those things and coming up with interesting ways to make that work. And the experience throughout Dev 11 is just going to get better and better and better, and you'll be able to share a lot more of that code.
Great. Now, in the case of like the Xbox, which of course has a super constrained memory architecture, and plus the... Is it still PowerPC chipset? I don't even know anymore.
I think,
do we know?
Yeah, I think
so. You guys probably had to do a ton of work just to get .NET to work well on there in the first place, right?
But I mean, like, they're not us. Some,
but I mean, the CLR people.
The team had to do some work to get... So there was work to get the runtime on Xbox. However, this team, like these guys here.
This interview.
The great guys.
Yeah.
Although, actually, a lot of the people who worked on that are actually on us, have joined our team.
Of course.
Yeah.
Kidding aside,
like I was trying to say, where we are in is the business of pure managed IL, as in no platform affinity. The fact that it's PowerPC or x86 or we don't care what doesn't really matter so much, but it doesn't matter to us, period.
Sure. At the library level.
At the library level.
Because what we want to get people to do is create these libraries that are as is, binary, as is, mm-hmm. reusable, Xcopy deployable, if you will, or whatever they want to deploy them as. So the architecture differences are not pertinent to us.
Sure. And now let's talk a little bit about the big news at Build, of course, we're all down there. And .NET, of course, is a first-class citizen in the WinRT programmable space. Mm-hmm. What work did you... So how does that work that world related to work that you've done.
Okay.
How's that?
So how about if we do...
Yeah, it might help if we start with the old world, how old world works.
Because then you understand what then problems have to be solved, and then you understand what...
That's beautiful.
We can do that.
Yeah, rock and roll.
So we can probably wind up with it.
See, okay. We got you on the whiteboard. All right.
Okay, so the world that we have today, you know, with phones, Silverlight, and .NET, we have these... circles. This circle represents, you know, the API surface area that a given platform supports. And, you know, today it looks something like this, where, you know, .NET lives here, SL lives here, we've got phone over here, and, you know, there's commonality in the middle here, where, you know, this is stuff like the networking stack, you know, the BCL, a lot of the BCL, XML, even WCF is in here, and then you've got these other areas here where, you know, this, oh no, sorry, actually this one here, this comes, you know, like there's MEF here, and you know, here there's system windows from SL to phone, yeah, and so forth. And so the way that we came up with the portable library, you know, the first version that we looked at was, as an after the fact, we basically did calculations over the current surface areas that we exposed today, and we said, okay, so what's commonality between these? You know, what is APIs live here? What APIs can we expose when you choose different platforms and so forth? And it was a very after the thought, you know, very, like MS CoreLib, for example, has different surface area on all these platforms. So then we end up generating an MS CoreLib that represents the, you know, the commonality between here. So we outcomes here is an MS CoreLib that you can pile against it, you know, a system.
And these are references, and these are not actual DLLs.
So these are what we call reference assemblies, which are, they're basically kind of like a header of .NET, where, you know, they don't contain any actual implementation code. They're just the exposed surface area that you program against. And then at runtime, what we do is we give these guys special names. If you're paying enough attention, you'll see that this is like, it has a name like this, where you have version 2.05, public key token that matches actually Silverlight, and then there's this little special bit that we added right at the end. This is part of the full name of it, strong name of it, where we go, this guy's retargetable. And so this is a special bit that has been around in the metadata spec for a while. We haven't used it a lot, but we used to use it for the old compact framework. But basically it means that what you program against, when you compile against this, this little bit says, at runtime, swap it for another MS CoreLib. So but when we just get rid of this, so we have, let's say, a portable library here. This is a user's customer's library, and they program against MS CoreLib and system. And then we come along and we run it on .NET and SL. So what happens is the runtime sees this reference here and says, oh, this is retargetable. Let's go and actually, this guy gets swapped for MS CoreLib on .NET, you know, with its public key inversion and so forth. On SL, it goes and says, oh, this MS CoreLib actually gets swapped for MS CoreLib from SL. And so the developer programs against these, you know, these theoretically different reference MS CoreLibs, but on the appropriate, you know, platform, they get swapped, you know, on the fly with the appropriate implementation. Now, the interesting thing about this is, if you're paying a close enough attention, there's some things where this gets interesting is SystemNet, for example. Now, for those who are watching this, they probably, you know, have noticed this is SystemNet on .NET actually contains different types to SystemNet on SL. So on SL being Silverlight, SystemNet contains all the networking stack, so HTTP web request, you know, web response, and so forth. On .NET, SystemNet contains actually unrelated types to that. The networking stack is actually in system.dll. So this is where this interesting part comes is, you know, on here, it's not a matter of just saying, oh, all these types here represent are in system.net, because what's going to happen is if we just swap this for this without doing anything else, you know, the runtime's going to look up here and say, oh, well, wait, this type doesn't exist in this assembly. Hmm. So what we end up doing here is we make use of this thing called type forwarding, where on .NET, so we have system.net, and we mark, basically put these attributes on top of it. They're attributes, but they're actually real metadata intrinsics, where we say, oh no, HTTP web request actually lives in system. So the user programs against system.net that, you know, is similar to the Silverlight service area, then gets run on system.net. The runtime says, okay, load system.net from .net. Oh, but those types that we're actually interested in actually live in system. So it's this really, under the covers, it's actually quite complicated, but basically we have to play these tricks all over the place, because on these different platforms, types live in certain locations. I notify property change is another good example, where I notify property change on Silverlight lives in system web, system window, sorry. On .NET it lives in system. Mm. So those we play these kind of these type forwarding tricks where we pretend that they're actually, you know, we pretend they're in a certain DLL, but then at runtime they get resolved back to their real location.
Okay.
There's a lot of this is how V1 works, and so with V1, as you probably noticed, things get, you know, it's quite tricky after, because we're thinking about portability after the fact rather than, you
just
know,
writing
from day
portable
one.
Libraries.
Yes,
yeah. And that's the best solution, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's for whatever reasons we you know, we kind of thinking this as, you know, after, and because of that, you know, things get a bit tricky, and it's a lot harder to do. Just people, a good example is people just say, you know, why aren't these types just automatically available in portable library? And it's, well, there's actually a bunch of work that we have to do underneath to make this work.
Sure. The other question one could ask is, why did Silverlight diverge from .NET? But that's a different question that we don't have to get into today.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, so you're trying to sort of navigate around decisions that were made and technical decisions that
yes.
were made. And it's, you know, it's noble work. But at the end of the day, it would be nice if there was a single portable library
yeah.
by design.
By design,
which, of course,
yeah.
you guys are probably moving towards.
Yeah, so that brings us on to the second
dun,
part.
Dun, dun, dun,
okay, so
Mitch?
I can talk
nice
first
job,
and then...
Man.
Okay. I can talk first and then do you want me to go there? But
yeah, go here.
Okay, fine.
Sure.
Right, so a couple of things from what David was talking that are important. They are... You'll notice if you open any MS Core Lib or any system core on any of these sort of platforms, like on .NET, on Silverlight, on Phone, on Xbox, although the assembly is called MS Core Lib or system core, it contains a variety of APIs, right? And that was because, well, not all APIs that are available in the full framework make sense, let's say, on Silverlight. And that's fine, of course. Yeah. Now, the problem with that is that as a developer, when you compile your code and you reference MS Core Lib, we had to do these sort of tricks with reference assembly such that you reference an MS Core Lib that is actually representing something that is available across the variety of platforms and so on. But now let's think it a bit further, right? So we have a variety of platforms coming out that are all .NET empowered, and they all evolve on their own rates, right? Like, you know, like they ship at different schedules for good reasons. And they all have different form factors, which means that not all APIs make sense on all of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, what is the common area between all of them? Well, we don't want to be in the business of constantly generating these sort of reference assemblies after the fact, and after the fact chasing teams, or hold on, like, you know, the APIs don't really are not really portable, and the customer is going to be confused. Not so, like, portability is an end goal, if you want, is the easiest step after you fix the other stuff before that, which is, if APIs do more or less the same thing, if they're in the same area, they should behave similarly. Like, why should you learn something else? Why should you keep a matrix in your mind of oh, but in this case it works like this, but in this other case it works like this, right? And here I have these members, but here I have these other members, and so on and so forth. This is a complex matrix to keep in your head as a developer, and it's something that we know, I mean, our test team knows especially, that it's hard to test for too, right? So what we ended up doing is we thought, well, since there's all of these platforms coming out, how would we actually think portability up from, how would portability be a first-class citizen? And if you notice in the Windows 8 profile for Metro Star applications, when you open a new project, a new class library or a new application, you don't necessarily see the reference assemblies that you're compiling against. But if you were to dig a bit deeper, and if you saw, or if you saw Christoph Solina's talk at Build, which I recommend you do watch, you would notice assemblies that you've never heard of, such as System Runtime DLL, or System Collections DLL, System Reflection DLL. And there's a good number of these guys. But if you look in them, you'll see well-known APIs, like System Runtime Define System Object, that you've probably heard of, and System String, and System Int, and so on and so forth. And System Collections, well, has all the dictionary and list and so on implementations, like the actual concrete classes, right? So what did we do here? Well, we thought like this. Let's identify groups of APIs that, and a group of such APIs we'll put in one reference assembly, and we'll give that reference assembly a name, right? And in each such reference assembly, the APIs would have similar characteristics in terms of portability. So either all or none makes sense to be ported on all .NET platforms, like, you know, they're very core, like the system runtime types, like object, string, well, they're core computer science type of types, like they make sense of anything that computes, right? Mm-hmm. Some of them could be optional, like, for example, some parallel computing type of implementations, well, perhaps you don't want a platform with those, so then those make sense only on those that you want to put them on. But the key characteristic is all the APIs in one such reference assembly have the same portability, same maturity characteristics, same the dependency graph between these reference assemblies makes sense. Like, you don't have things like in order to do core, you know, in programming, you don't need also reflection, because you don't actually, right? So we did a lot of this sort of cleanup and organization in these reference assemblies. So now when you compile, like, the idea is that when you compile against, you know, you have your library here, this is me.dll, I'll be referencing these reference assemblies, we call them API contracts, that I actually need, right? So if I just do some math type of thing, so maybe I use system runtime, and then system collections maybe. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like, let's just keep it to that, right? So this is my little math DLL, or maybe it's a chess engine or something, and I end up just programming against APIs here, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is we are going to enable portability by supporting these guys as is on the other platforms that they should be supported on. So then you don't, you know, like, this will just work because your references are satisfied. And the work is in ensuring that these contracts are actually fully supported on upcoming platforms. But what I can spend a bit more time on is explaining actually how do we make this run, and how what you'll actually end up seeing at runtime.
Great.
Right? So let's go ahead with that. So these are things that you see at compile time. If you open with IL-DASM or with Reflector or something, if you go to system runtime DLL, the reference assembly, which is in your program files, reference assemblies folder, you will see a bunch of type being declared there, and these are reference assemblies, so they don't have any implementation. They're just metadata, right? Okay, great. And this guy, like any of these, it's technically an assembly that has an identity, so it has a name, so system. Do you have another one?
Yeah.
You guys get the ink out of it. Nice.
Thanks.
All right.
Okay, system.
No.
It's not one of those. Huh? You know, it has a version 4.0.0.0. It has a key. So, remember, and this other guy has a similar thing, system collection, some version, and some key. At runtime, this was, as it was explained in the various talks that I was mentioning before at Build, you'll actually notice that me.dll being reused from some Windows Metro style public app is actually running on the 4.5 bits. So how come? Because, I mean, you know, object is in MS Colib, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 4.5 is not breaking the existing 4.0 customers. So how did we make it happen? Well, we just did a lot of type forwarding, basically. This is the gist of it. We did a lot of one thing that we've done in the past a bit of, and now we've done a lot of.
Okay.
So here's how it works. In the GAC, on your box, you will... So you have MS Colib. System, you know, the usual suspects. System core. You'll also notice, if you go in the GAC, you'll notice a system runtime. Okay, so there is a system runtime there. And the system collections. In fact, you'll notice for each of the new faces, there is one guy here in the GAC.
Okay.
But if you look at this guy here, so this is GAC. If you look at this guy inside, if you open it up with Altasm, he has nothing other than type forwards. So this guy says that, yeah, system object, it's here. System string, here. Right?
Okay.
Stuff like this. System URI, which happens to be here, it's here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So effectively what happens is, although me.dll has no mention of MS Corlib or system or any of the old surface areas, we call it, and talks only about the new surface area, as an implementation detail, when it starts running, when it's being loaded and the references are resolved, we land back on the implementations that we had before. So it's very similar to something that Windows did, which is called API sets, I believe, in Windows 7 or Vista, I forgot when, which is a very similar concept. They basically organized APIs in a slightly different way based on their goals,
mm-hmm.
but to ensure compat, in the same way, they are calling back into the existing functionality. And there was a demo, I believe, last PDC, perhaps, that describes this in great detail for the Windows side. It's a very similar concept, basically.
Okay.
So you compile against these differently organized surface areas, and you actually end up running on as an implementation detail on the 4.5 machine on 4.5 bits. Now, the thing is that we have total freedom now on implementing these guys as we see fit on other form factors. So, for example, if we decide to have like a very small form factor that goes, let's say, on a watch or I don't know what, like, you know, mm-hmm. it's complete out of the blue speculation.
Yeah.
Not even a speculation. Like, let's just play with it.
Yeah.
And we just say, well, we support these exact two things. We could actually put them in one big assembly or in two different ones, or as we see fit for that. But we'd still play the same sort of tricks, but in a platform-specific way there, meaning there would be a system runtime there that would forward in that implementation, or that would actually contain the implementation in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically the mechanism that we enable portability as a first-class citizen. We say developers fall into the pit of success of building DLLs that are portability-enabled, mm-hmm. right? By portability-enabled, I mean they will work on... the goal is to make it such that they would work on whichever platform of the day or the future supports the APIs that they need.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of what... I think it's a fair thing to say, well, if you're using things like, you know, if you do ASP programming, well, you're not portable, right? But if you're doing something like a chess engine, you kind of should, right? So the expectation that you have is seamlessly supported underneath, basically, for you, right?
Sure.
This entire mechanism effectively gets us out of the business of having to regenerate intersections all the time, right? Because we're not in the business of, hold on, was it the right intersection? We're rather in the business of saying, okay, well, when we move .NET, we're going to... The goal is to move it such that it supports these things, right? So portability comes as a first-class citizen rather than afterwards.
Cool. Yeah. So basically, portable library doesn't become, you know, this calculation of intersections and, you know, let's take the watch idea. You know, if watch says it supports, you know, one version, let's say 4.01 of this contract, and .NET says it supports 4.0, then what we can do is, you know, portability, just the new portable library could just be, oh, we just take the lowest intersection of here, and, you know, we just pick this guy. You can now compile against this guy instead of, you know, calculating, having these assemblies on the side that, you know, that we have to pre-calculate and generate and, you know, ship and support. Instead, it's just a matter of just grabbing this, you know, this contract from here, and, you know, you can do the same thing with all the collections and so forth, and you end up just picking the lowest common denominator of all these platforms. As you add more platforms, you know,
we effectively raise the granularity level. Like, rather than having a granularity level, before it was the level of any particular member. Any member was free game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that proved to be too low, because the right granularity level in .NET happens to be assemblies, because that's what you actually reference and that's what the runtime understands.
Mm.
But the assemblies that we had in the past were way too big. Like, MS Corlib had lots of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the desktop, it's a 4 meg monster, right? So
yeah.
We basically said, well, there is a constraint in the runtime, which is that assemblies are the right granularity level. They are actually, in terms of what you see at compile time, they're the wrong size right now. So let's design them so that they're the right size, so that things just pour in the right way.
Good.
That's
excellent. So, I mean, .NET's evolving, right?
Yeah, that's the goal.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
Now, the one question I would have sort of about the GAC, in the Windows 8 world, you guys have just one GAC or do you have two? And I mean that because...
Why would there be a second one?
Well, because you have desktop mode and you have metro mode, right? You have full .NET and you have not full .NET.
I see. There is, like, today the way things work is there's one GAC that contains all of these guys, like the 4 or 5 implementations and all of these. And the metro mode is a process, it's under us, basically. It's a concept that Windows has, which is a particular kind of a process.
Mm-hmm.
And there's particular rules that we know in the runtime to disable or enable when you are in such a process. But it's effectively it's a lower than managed, so it's an unmanaged concept that happens there.
A native concept.
Yeah, it's a
good.
Managed or native. Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer native myself.
Yeah.
All right, that's cool, man. I was just curious. To be honest, the first time I thought about the GAC in Metro and desktop mode. But anyway. That's very cool. What else?
One thing that developers will start noticing as they start programming against this new service area is that, you know, they'll start noticing changes. You know, to make these references work, you know, we had to kind of break certain dependencies and so forth. A good example of this is type. So,
Okay, fair enough.
Yep. So, type today lives in MS Corlib. Okay. And it's a very core concept used throughout MS Corlib and the entire framework. But one thing you'll notice is that, you know, as Mitch said before, we have system runtime, DLL, and we have system reflection, DLL. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here. So if we were to, you know, kind of put type in here, you'd end up having this very core concept, you know, the int object and so forth, have these dependencies on what is, you know, a more high-level type, which is type itself. So, you know, member info and assemblies and so forth, you know...
Well, that's because... Maybe, I don't know how much people know this, but I mean... That's because type, the way you know it on 4.5, depends in the public surface area on things like member info and you know, property info and so on, because it has members that return them or take them as parameters. And when you do the transitive closure of all of that, you end up with a lot of types.
Yes, you end up pulling in things like culture info and you know, globalization. You know, it was in the order of 200 or 300 types.
We did a quick toy experiment, right? Like, how many types do you think that system string depends on today in the full framework, just from a public surface area perspective? And the answer was something like 1,500 or something.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, because, you know, like, well, it itself, you know, like, it shows, like, int and this and that, but then it has from object, it has get type. Well, you look at type, it pulls, you know, member info, globalization. Globalization pulls, you know, like, and so on and so forth, and when you finally close it, it's humongous. So 1,500 is not really a core, right?
Hmm. No, I hope not.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so one of the things that we did here was we ended up breaking type into two. So today you have system.type right here, and then you have the system.reflection namespace with member info and method info and field info and so forth and all the infos. So what we ended up doing is we ended up inventing a new type called type info, right? And we ended up making type what in metadata we call is basically a type reference. So in metadata there's kind of three terms for three type types of types. Yes. There's a type ref, which is a reference to one assembly to another. So you may if I compile against system string, then I'll have a type ref in my assembly that refers to mscallib or system runtime and so forth. Then there's what we call a type spec, which is a type spec is a compound type. So a compound type is something like an array or a generic instantiation of a type and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we have these things called type defs, and a type def is something that actually contains the definition of the type. The members, attributes of these things.
When you write code in your assembly,
mm-hmm. That's a type def. So one of the things we did here was we split type, and we said, oh, this guy now is just basically the type ref and the type spec.
So it's an indirection, effect.
It's an indirection, and type info becomes the type def. So this guy contains the dependencies on member info and fields and so forth, and contains information about the type. That in typical terms you would need to resolve that assembly. So the way that reflection in the past, they kind of had this type object that would resolve assemblies when you didn't even know about it and so forth. And you want to look at the return type of this method. Well, to do that in reflection today, you have to basically resolve that return type and then any dependencies it has and any base classes and so forth. So this kind of sets us in this world where, we can kind of separate the reference to the type to the actual definition. It's almost like the assembly name. If you compare an assembly name to an assembly name contains enough information to find the assembly, mm-hmm. but it doesn't contain information about the assembly. And mm-hmm. and you can imagine, you can think of type ref and type spec as that. The type ref is enough information to find the type but it's not enough information to actually get the type's information. So, it's very easy to just go back and forth between these two, but, you can just call get type info and we'll return one of these.
Okay.
But this kind of sets us in a good direction going forward. If you have a look at how, reflection-only load works and so forth, these things aren't as nice. If you want to look at it, an attribute on an assembly, for example, mm-hmm. you have to sign up to basically resolving all the dependencies that assembly could ever have, because asking for this attribute over here means that it could return a type that lives in another assembly now, so you have to, the runtime will call you back for that mm-hmm. and so forth. So it's quite, just to inspect an assembly, it's you're signing up for a lot of things that you shouldn't really have to. And
sure.
for those that have used CCI, and there's an external version of CCI, which is basically, it's a very similar concept that we're kind of borrowing from CCI, where it separates the refs from the defs. And,
cool.
To get to a definition and to sign up into resolving and so forth, it's a method call so that you know when that happens and so forth.
Great. By the way, this is the biggest. This is, so David picked this example well because it's actually the biggest change that we did. The rest of them are not that big. Like, I mean, the rest of the kind of effort that we did in this new profile are well-known, deprecated, or advised against types or members. Well, mm-hmm. If we told you not to use them, we actually remove them, right?
Sure.
Things like this, that, I mean, they're already anywhere on the cutting block or on the please don't use, so now they went away. This is the one and only large change and large and visible.
Absolutely. That's a big one.
I mean, we added some what we call kind of good changes, which is a good example that we started in Portable Library and we took that to WinAP was the close versus dispose.
WinAP is the internal name we have
for the service area that ships on the .NET.
We have to say something quick.
Okay, Mary Joe, that doesn't have any meaning at all.
Yes, it has absolutely no meaning.
Well, it does to you. It doesn't anyone else.
Yeah, it's just another name for .NET for Metro style. One of the examples we chose was close versus dispose. If you look at the old guidelines, the framework design guidelines for, you know, Christoph Reitz, who works on our team, one of the guidelines they used to have was around having, you know, more descriptive names or names that fit in for dispose. So an example being file stream. You know, we had filestream.close because when you're programming against a file, I mean, close to most developers makes sense. But when, you know, at a very isolated point, that kind of makes sense. But if you go further out and look at the .NET framework as a whole, you'll find that developers are actually get confused because they don't know what close means and what dispose means.
Yes.
Do I call close? Do I call dispose? What happens if I call in a using block? What happens if I, you know, and then we tried to fix that by in 2.0. We added close and dispose on FileStream, and that ended up adding more confusion.
So just get rid of close.
So one of the my pet peeves was this close versus dispose thing, and you know we tried very hard and we succeeded in basically getting rid of close. So now we have dispose, and you know all these objects implement public disposes that you call, and you know now when you new developers that approach this, you know for seasoned developers the close versus dispose thing you've kind of worked it out, but for new developers, you know, there may be a little bit of a stumbling to get to what is this dispose thing, but once you've got that little bump, you know, dispose is...
And there's more value, we think, like, and actually now that we think based on evidence, which is feedback or usability experiments, that some APIs or some particular terms might make a lot of sense when you look in an isolated, like David was saying, in an isolated problem domain specific. From an isolated problem domain specific perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, file close, we all know that. Like, I mean, I think that in most places where I did something with files, even if it wasn't .NET or Microsoft, it was kind of called close or something like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we are actually primarily .NET developers, not file developers, right? Like, I mean, typically you're a developer that uses .NET and then you're trying to do programming on whatever .NET happens to be, right? And the less you have to learn new, the better, especially for things that kind of do the same thing. So If you are told that there is dispose and but actually it's all closed, well, you can understand where the confusions are coming from.
Of course.
And there's issues like, well, can I use using done or can't I? So does it do the same thing? So all of these things are snags in your normal flow. So there is a snag in saying, well, actually it's file dispose, not closed. But I think that it seems that the impact is way smaller given that it's at least consistent and it's one. Versus the impact of, oh, hold on, it's actually another one, and maybe it's different, and all of these kinds of differences. So it's very, like, what we found from our experience is that the questions that, the right question in a lot of these cases is not, does it work? Well, yeah, it works in software. Like, I mean, I bet it works, as it works, right? The question is, but how easy?
Yeah.
How natural does it feel to you? How different is it, or how not so different is between a platform and another one? And the goal is to actually make sure that the differences are coherent, where they make sense.
And you know, Christoph Solina. He has an incredibly interesting first name when you spell it out.
Yes, I
can't spell it either.
I've been working with him for 3 years, and I still can't spell it.
Yeah.
But he talks about that, about what was removed and why.
Yep.
And in some sense, it's, you know, from what I can sense, this is like all of this kind of coherence and focus on the really big release has really, I think, made .NET evolve better. I think .NET's going to come out of this much better.
Yeah. So, you know, most of the decisions that we make, you know, we just didn't think, oh yeah, we'll just do this for the hell of it. It was more the, you know, we most of the things that we made, the decisions we made, they have a you know, a real reason behind them. And you know, I imagine, you know, we're reacting to the feedback. I mean, we're paying a lot of attention to customers' feedback around this and trying to make things a little bit more, you know, where we broke a dependency and it's a little harder to use, then we'll try and, you know, add some bridge APIs to make this easier. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in the long term, .NET's going to be a lot better off, mm-hmm. You know, around this, and you know, as we bring this you know, this surface area onwards, you know, it's with portability in mind and so forth, you know, the customer value is going to be, you know, so tenfold, yeah, kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very cool, you guys. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk about this on Channel 9.
Yeah.
And good luck as you march into the future.
Thank you.
All right, take care, you guys.
Yeah, thanks.